Our special guest tonight is a man who's lived a good portion of his early life, at least, in the White House. He wasn't elected, but his grandfather was. My guest is Curtis Roosevelt. You are the eldest grandson of FDR, is that right?
I am, and my sister and I are the only grandchildren, being the eldest, who actually lived with our grandparents. And my great-grandmother, FDR's mother, Sarah Delano Roosevelt, was like a surrogate mother to me. I'm out of another age.
Yes, you are. And you know, reading your book, I was struck by one thing. I've got a connection for you. You live in France now.
Yes.
And you know, of course, the work of Simone de Beauvoir.
Oh, yes.
Her memoir is titled Une jeune fille rangée, an obedient young daughter. I think this one of yours, if you publish it, if you have it translated and published in France, might well be subtitled, at least, Un jeune fils rangé. You are a very obedient son.
That is the way it was to be. I was brought up to be obedient.
Yeah, and everything.
I had better manners at the age of 3 or 4 than I do today.
I would hope so. You're entitled to a little bit of latitude.
Yeah,
you're a senior person.
No, I knew what to do, what not to do, yeah. Keep my mouth shut.
I was particularly struck by, there are many things that strike me as just kind of startling. One is that you weren't allowed to wear long pants until, what, the age of 9 or 10?
10.
Yeah.
10 years old.
It was just considered inappropriate for an 8-year-old boy to wear long pants, was it?
You just didn't do it. I mean, you didn't move. I mean, it was the custom.
Uh-huh.
And here I was going to public school, and I was the only kid in short pants. It made you stand out. But I was different. I was special. And this was a very distorting factor in my life.
But you did learn how to be polite to butlers serving lunch and dinner.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I now am very hard on waiters and waitresses who don't live up to standards, because I was brought up to standards.
Well, these weren't just the standards that prevailed worldwide or countrywide. This is upper-class behavior of that time and place.
Absolutely. People forget that FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt were, we would call it today, aristocrats, because we don't like to use the word upper class. But we used it in those days. When I was a child, we were a class society. Pre-World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So life was very different then. And you wouldn't make a reference to somebody today who doesn't know their place. And yet that was very much in that I was raised to know my place, because the butler knew his place, the nurse knew her place, the cook knew his place, my great-grandmother knew her place.
I found it most interesting, moving, affecting, that though there was much affection from some distance from your grandparents and from your mother, the person who really was closest in your life in the very early years was your black nurse.
She was.
Bibi, isn't that her name?
Bibi was what we called her. Betty was, in fact, her name. But she gave of herself to me while keeping me very much in tow. We were kept on a very short leash. Not just for security reasons. That was a problem. We had the limber baby killed a year after we moved into the White House. No, we were just, for reasons we've reviewed, just it was the style of life. But Bibi had that quality of just picking me up, and life was made whole.
She
in
was
her
a up. Whereas, maternal capacity.
Yeah, whereas the typical thing in the upper class, children raised in that system, was that they were held at a distance from their parents, and they had been turned over to nurses and then governesses, and they perhaps saw their parents on, as I write in my book, by schedule.
Longfellow, someplace in a poem, doesn't he have the line, "This is the pause in the day's occupations known as the children's hour"?
Yes, yes.
And there was a pause in the day's occupations, when even your very busy grandfather, who had a country to run and then a war to run, would come and fool around with you for a while.
Well, he didn't come in. We went into him.
Yeah.
One forgets he was completely crippled. So he'd be in his bed, propped up, And maybe he'd still be finishing his breakfast.
Well, you were with him at the levee in the morning.
Yes, and he'd be having his immediate staff around him.
Right.
They'd be reviewing who they had to see, also making jokes about these people, and having a... He always had fun. Whatever he did, he made fun of it. Not at it, with it. But they would stop. And I'd known all these people for as long as I could remember, because they'd been on his staff in Albany. Some of them even on his staff when he ran for vice president in 1920.
Which people are we talking about? Louis Howe.
Missy Lehan, Louis Howe. Although Louis Howe got too sick to attend. But basically, Missy, mm-hmm. Louis Howe, Marvin McIntyre, Paul Watson, the usual crowd. Oh, Steve Early sometimes, mm-hmm. too. Press secretary, appointment secretary, cabinet secretary. These were the White House was a very much smaller scene, but they would stop and they'd join in the fun. And FDR would then perhaps he would read the funnies if there was a and he would ham it up.
You read the funnies to you and your sister.
Well, theoretically, but the way he was hamming it up, he was building in other things, and they would be having a good
time. The other great funnies reader of that period, more or less, was Fiorello LaGuardia.
That's right.
But he did it on the radio to all the children of New York.
Well, he did it for the children. FDR was doing it for us. But he would play and tickle and funny little games. But what? We were talking about 5-6 minutes.
It's interesting. You make very clear that you had deep affection for him and reverence for him, and your term for him was Papa, or maybe you said Papa.
Papa, equal emphasis on both syllables. Yeah. Papa.
You had two other Papas. You had your real father, and you had, after a while, a stepfather. But neither of them had that significance in your life.
Unfortunately, my father would have, but he was demonized.
Yeah. Wasn't allowed into the White House.
That's correct. And it's one of those odd things when you think of Eleanor Roosevelt, you can't imagine her demonizing anybody. But let me tell you, my father was demonized by Eleanor Roosevelt, with my mother right in there, too. To some degree, she did a number, you might say, on her mother-in-law as well.
That's Curtis Dahl.
Curtis Dahl is my father. Dahl is my last name.
And then what did the ladies have against him?
I cannot really tell you, because that's one of the mysteries. Mm-hmm. He didn't drink too much. I mean, he wasn't a drunk, whereas all my uncles drank heavily. My grandmother's brother, Hall, was an alcoholic and a womanizer and so forth. My father was not a womanizer, not any of the things. However, he had worked on Wall Street, and my grandmother thought that Wall Street was, and the people on Wall Street were behind the Great Depression. This is not a very, shall I say, rational opinion, and I'm sure she withdrew from it as she became better acquainted.
But he also lost much of his fortune in the Great...
I don't know that he lost... everything, including his seat on the exchange.
And they held that against him as well.
And they held that against him. He owed quite a lot of money to my grandfather and to a cousin who happened to be my godfather. That was held against him. But if you add up all of those factors, it still doesn't signify and justify the demonizing that took place.
The image of your grandfather that comes through, and of your grandmother, both of them very significant people, very significant in our history, is rather novel. We've heard a great deal about both of them, but we got a different sense of them from through your child's eyes, so to speak.
Yes.
And I want to go on to talk about that when we return, right after we pause, to do what we can to shore up the economy with these words. We're back on the air, engaged in what I find to be equally interesting conversation privately. And you were, if I may, I'll activate some portion of that private conversation and get into what you were just talking about so that all can hear it. You were saying that the very title of your book, Too Close to the Sun, the sun being Franklin Roosevelt, obviously.
Yeah.
And Eleanor as well.
And Eleanor as well, like two sons in your life.
But that this perhaps not only affected your life, but may have overawed you in some way. And you say it had the same effect on virtually all members of the family.
All members of the family, without exception. We talked of James Roosevelt. And
we were just talking privately of James, Jimmy Roosevelt,
yes,
who was the eldest son.
And on your program, you said.
He appeared on this program
a number of years ago.
In the early, mid-1980s, I would guess.
Well, you know, he had a very good mind, charming as could be, capable. But he gave up his congressional seat and ran very unwisely for governor of the state of California against Earl Warren, who later became became governor of California and then Supreme Court Justice. But he never fulfilled the promise. But of course, Franklin Jr., who had started a career in politics in New York and went to Congress, and he just thought he could get by. He had two terms in Congress and one of the worst attendance records in of any of the congressmen. But they had, all my uncles had a sense of that, and were really, I think, most comfortable with their identity as the president's sons.
Mm-hmm.
It gave them the most satisfaction.
Gave entree and entitlement, did it?
Entree and entitlement, and there were always people willing to shell out money, shell out positions. I mean, Franklin was a law clerk at when I remember seeing him during a vacation in New York, and I came back the following year, 12 months later, and Franklin was in the senior partner's office. The law firm had given him the senior partner's position, 51% of the law firm. And what did he have to do? He just had to sit there and greet warmly potential clients, and that was all there was to it. One of his partners later said to me, "You know, your uncle has a brilliant mind," and Franklin did. "He could have been really superb at any element of the law, and he didn't bother with any of them."
Well, let's come to the man at the center of it all, Franklin
yes.
Delano Roosevelt. What do we not properly understand about him, which you think those who knew him closely, as you did, can enlighten us upon?
Well, it's not great enlightenment, but I see lots of quotes from FDR.
Mm-hmm.
That help historians, biographers, journalists illustrate what they want to illustrate. So it's not just taking something out of context, but it's missing the fact, to give you one answer. FDR always had fun. He always had this amusement. And I can give you one quick example.
Please do, yes.
There was a time in the 30s when the U.S. went off the gold standard and therefore had to fix the price of gold every day. And a man who became very well known, Dean Acheson, was then Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. And he had to come in to FDR's bedroom, join that circle we talked about a few minutes ago, and fix the price of gold with FDR. Well, my sister and I might burst in at that point, and Dean Acheson just had to wait because we were more important to the president. As he writes, Acheson writes in his biography, he seemed more interested in playing with his grandchildren than he did
He had to read the comics to you before setting the price of gold.
Before fixing the price of gold. Well, one day he fixed the price of gold, and Henry Morgenthau, his Secretary of the Treasury, said to him, "Franklin, why?" You could call him Franklin because he was neighbors, and Henry Morgenthau was Uncle Henry to me as a child. Anyway, "Franklin, why did you fix the price of gold at $21? And FDR looked at him with an absolutely straight face and said, "But Henry, 3 times 7's a lucky number." well, Henry Morgenthau did eventually laugh. But I mean, that was, but I've seen that quoted to illustrate how little FDR knew about economics.
Or rather, what it illustrates, I suppose, is that...
But it just, he had fun with everything.
He was given to humorous teasing.
Yeah. And he and Churchill used to exchange views and so forth. But I think it's one aspect that he... Well, he did give the nod to Harry Truman to become his running mate in 1944. And, of course, a few months later, Truman became president.
Well, did he really give the nod? There are those who interpret that nomination as sort of a revolt of the party against him, that he still wanted Henry Wallace.
No, I think, at least I have a different take on it. He wanted Henry Wallace in 1940 because he hoped that Henry Wallace would carry on his traditions.
Yeah.
And he didn't even know at that time whether he would be a candidate or not. Anyway, he was Henry Wallace, vice president. Henry Wallace had no political skills. Henry Wallace did not make it with the Democrats, and that was plain enough in the 1940 convention. But he, by 1944, he was in a bind. FDR was in a bind. He owed Henry Wallace loyalty. But on the other hand, he did not want Henry Wallace to continue running as his, to continue in another term.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to do a balancing act of supporting but not supporting. And if you look at the day-by-day development of the things, FDR would say, of course I'm backing Henry Wallace. But then at the same time, he would say to other people, well, I don't know. I mean, I certainly don't want to dictate the... delegates' choice, you know, opening the door just a crack. And that's all you need.
Coming back to your and your family's, that is your mother and your sister, and your connection with your grandparents, you all move into the White House only shortly after the inauguration in 1933. And you stay there for about, what is it, the following 4 or 5 years?
Until I was 7.
Until you're 7, and then your mother remarries.
Correct.
And Mr. How do you say the name?
Bodiger.
Bodiger. And
He had been a crack reporter for the Chicago Tribune.
Yeah, but at that point he has made a connection out in Seattle.
Well, he married my mother, and it was considered that it really wasn't a good thing. So he really went to work first for the Hayes organization, just as a filler for a couple of years.
Then he winds up at the Seattle
Post-Intelligencer,
which went out of business already
a few weeks ago. Digital about a week or two.
So you all moved out to Seattle.
So I began shuttling back and forth on these long train rides between Washington and Seattle. And in those years, it was a long train ride.
4 or 5 days.
Yes. But it was a totally disastrous experience for me because I was taken out of the milieu that I knew about. I was getting out of my being special, going to a private school in New York City, and thrust into public school out there where I was a bit of a freak. I was taken into class the first day. We were late because of staying for the inauguration, so I was taken in the class and introduced by the principal as, this is Buzzy. He's been living in the White House with the President and Mrs. Roosevelt. That was my introduction to my mates in my school. It was a disaster and went on that way.
And there you were in your short pants as well.
And I'm, of course, in my short pants.
We'll pick up that story from there. Of course, you're back in the White House a great deal during those later years.
Yes, during those years.
And one thing that does fascinate me is that same buoyancy that we find in FDR, which you talk about, that high sense of humor, that untouchable optimism, in a way, seems to persist even through the war years. That is really quite a revelation. And I hope to discuss that with you when we return after an update on this evening's news from Paula Cooper. And we return directly to Curtis Roosevelt. And let me persist with the question I was raising just a moment ago. I'm right, am I not, that even during the war years, when, for example, Churchill during the war years was capable of great occasional depressions, as reported by his physician, Lord Moran. When
depression?
Churchill, absolutely.
Oh, Churchill, yes. Yeah. I'm sorry, I thought you said FDR.
What Churchill called the black dog.
That's right. That he did
came
have
upon
his...
him. And Lincoln, we know, suffered mm-hmm. bouts of depression mm-hmm. in the White House during the Civil War. And maybe Stalin got depressed, or Hitler had every reason to be depressed. But your grandfather, even in the bad, the hard times in the first year of the war, seems to have remained rather perky.
I think so. I don't know. You know, talking on the way over here about what did FDR, how he recovered from polio. And he didn't. He didn't change physically mm-hmm. one iota. All those years he put in exercises and dragging himself around and all the things that you do for therapy did not produce one bit of change. And swimming in the warm pool and warm springs was simply that the water was holding him up and he could play water polo and dunk people and have fun. And he did and enjoyed it. But what he learned, I think, is fairly obvious. How to deal with frustration. You know, he was on his way to being president once he'd done that vice presidential stint with Cox in mm-hmm. 1920.
When Harding wins and they lose.
Well, of course, Harding and Coolidge were a shoo-in.
Yeah.
Cox and Roosevelt were running on, let's join the League of Nations, hardly a ticket to win Americans' hearts. But... He was within a stone's throw if he'd moved on to being senator or governor or something of the sort. And then he's nothing. He was written off as a has-been.
One day swimming up there at Campobello.
He gets polio, yeah. And it nearly kills him. Moved up very close to his heart and then back down and settled permanently in the hips. And so from the hips down, he had no feeling. I think he learned the fortitude and to be buoyant, because not to be buoyant would be depressed. So I don't know whether he was depressed or not, but if he was, he certainly had put it aside. After all, he could very well have been depressed, thinking of as the only thing that really interested him in politics was now down the tube.
Yeah.
Due to his
poem. And he has to fight his way back. He doesn't come automatically to the presidency.
No.
He decides to run for governor of New York, and he achieves that position.
Well, he barely won. The first time it
yeah.
was a very close race. But then after that. But you know, during that first campaign, he and Louis Howe were very concerned as to whether a cripple could be elected. People like Al Smith had said, you can't elect a cripple to anything. But he was, then the second time. And by that time, it was very plain the American public would ignore it. And that is what is left out of the memorial down in Washington, both in the interpretation by the Park Service and by even having that statue of FDR in a wheelchair. Look, can you imagine today... electing a cripple president of the United States. Well, we did elect a cripple four times, 32, 36, 40, and 44.
Of course, the fact that he was crippled was known, but somehow the whole thing was handled with a kind of a finesse and a kind of flummery which minimized our awareness of it, I gather.
I do not think there was this splendid deception as... oh, gosh, his name's gone out of my mind, who wrote the book about that. Hugh Gallagher. I don't think it was what he did, if I can put it in other ways, he didn't want to rub the nose of the American mm-hmm. people in his disability. So, yes, it was minimized. But it was the press corps in Washington that agreed among themselves not to have pictures taken of FDR that would show him either being brought in on a wheelchair or carried upstairs or something.
There is a very touching moment, which we've got preserved on video, of course, when he returns from the Yalta Conference and addresses the Congress.
Yeah.
And for the first time, well, and he says to them as he begins, I've just come back from this long, long journey. It's been rather wearying, and I trust you will forgive me if for once I speak to you while seated rather than wearing 20 pounds of metal around my legs.
People don't realize that in those days, the braces that a paraplegic could wear were metal.
Yeah.
And the only protection they had, because your weight was on whatever was left of your knees and ankles, and your entire weight was on that bone against a leather padding on the metal. People don't realize that for FDR, it was a very painful experience. So when you see him so-called walking, he wasn't walking. He learned how to throw his hips forward and always supported in a tripod on his cane on somebody's arm. And he learned how to do this, but it was a painful thing to do. And it was and not easy. And as he got older, he, of course, didn't have the strength. And, you know, I'm a good deal older than my grandfather was when he died. And may I tell you, you don't have the strength.
He was only 64 or thereabouts at his death.
Right. But he looked a lot older. The war really aged him. People don't recognize that he worked 7 days a week, 12, 15 hours a day.
I think it was Justice Holmes who said of the young Franklin Roosevelt that he's got a second-rate mind but a first-rate temperament.
Hmm.
And somebody did a biography of FDR later.
Jeffrey Ward.
Titled First-Rate Temperament.
Right.
Is that a fair judgment?
Yes, because Holmes's definition of a first-rate mind would be an academic one. One capable of academic achievement, and I know you were a professor, so I say that with some trepidation.
I think they've got third-rate minds in the main.
All right, but to me, FDR used his mind differently, and what has now been labeled or recently lateral thinking, he was able to jump from one subject to and move back and forth. Review options in a way that would not necessarily be acceptable in an academic way. And it used to drive his brain trust nuts. You read Ray Moley's comments or Rex Stugwell's or so forth, and they're very critical that he doesn't use his mind very well. Well, no, not in their sense. Or you get this criticism of when he was presented with two economic plans, rather from academic sources, diametrically opposed, and he told them, well, would you please sit together? I'll give you till tomorrow morning to come up with something that is between your two proposals. Well, academically, the two proposals were so far apart, you couldn't put them together. What he was aiming at is, you're not reaching the needs of people. Both of your programs deal in a theoretical basis with the economy. I need to get people employed again. I need to get people back to work. This was his aim, and this was why he was dismissive both generally of the academic community and also of the what he called the striped pants boys in the State Department.
Yet he did develop a group around him. I think, did he label them the Brains Trust, or did some journalist come up with that term?
I think
Ray Moley and Rex Tugwell were among them.
Yeah, Ray Moley was probably quite happy to be more or less the chairman of that little group. I don't know who labeled them as such, but they became known as that. But you don't hear much about them after the mid-1930s.
A fascinating figure in that entourage and playing a very special role. I wonder how much contact you had with him. Was Harry Hopkins.
Oh, very well. Well, he lived in the White House and saw him every day.
Yes, he did live there for part of the time. And his daughter was one of your few playmates, I gather.
Yes, that's correct. And I still see her in Washington,
Diana. Isn't that wonderful?
Yes. And no, she's written a wonderful, not written, but it's an oral history in the library at Hyde Park, the Roosevelt Library. And she corroborates much of what I've said of how my grandmother didn't have that ease of giving which FDR had.
Yeah.
And her description of that and her relationship.
Indeed, it is time to talk about the two elder Roosevelt women.
After we
pause for some overdue commercials, namely your mother and your grandmother, who comes through as quite a charming and fascinating character in this book. I've never read about Sarah Delano Roosevelt in quite those terms before. We return to Curtis Roosevelt after we pause for this. And we return to Curtis Roosevelt. And we should talk about your grandmother. Grand-mère, you called her.
Grand-mère, the French grandmother. In order to differentiate it from Granny, who was my great-grandmother, Sarah Delano Roosevelt, FDR's mother.
You're fonder of her, it seems to me, than you are of your grandmother.
Very different. Granny provided that same open warmth, love, that my black mammy did.
Mm-hmm.
That same sense of ease, of giving of herself. And nobody was more of an aristocrat than Granny. And yet she was one of those people who accepted with real sense of obligation the noblesse oblige of her class. Lots of people didn't, but she did. And that's what I was brought up on. My grandmother was, in a very different way, I came to love and respect, but only in my mature years. And I saw a lot of my grandmother. All through until she died. I was in the East in New York City and would be at Hyde Park or seeing her in New York regularly. I went to Paris with her in 1948 when I was 18 to the UN, the General Assembly, which passed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And in my second book, I'll have an essay recording just what a political pro she was.
But you felt that in relation to you and your sister was with you in those White House years. She's, what, 3 years older than you are?
Yes, but she's chosen to turn away and not, she would deny that her primary identity is, that I don't.
But I meant to say that you feel that Eleanor was rather, if not distant, at least rather rather unresponsive to the two of you. Not as easy
not,
and as,
not just the two of
as
us.
Comfortable as her husband.
No, the family joke was...
She was thick with everybody.
Yeah, except the people, the further away you were, the less responsibility you had, the warmer and more open Eleanor Roosevelt could be. Total stranger, she'd throw her arms around you.
That's that famous cartoon which you do mention, two coal miners deep underground. Yeah. What turns and says, oh, my God, there's Eleanor Roosevelt.
Here comes Eleanor Roosevelt.
Here comes Eleanor Roosevelt.
Here comes Eleanor Roosevelt. No, my uncles used to joke about it. And there was... they all harbored resentment against her. I remember my mother once, in later years, not too long before my grandmother died, she insisted that she and a second stepfather, please come. They'll have the whole weekend. There'll only be the three of us here. Nobody, and my mother was delighted because she never had much of a chance to talk as she wanted to her mother. So they changed all their pants, put the dogs in the kennel, go to a lot of work, fly in from Michigan up to Hyde Park to discover that there are about 12 other guests, and she has as much chance of talking to her mother. Not much.
I had one brief contact with your grandmother.
Yeah?
I was a kid, assistant professor at Yale, and was doing a course down at the Bank Street School of Education in New York for one quarter. And they had some special occasion where, I forget what the topic was, but we were all pontificating on the topic. But the featured speaker was Eleanor Roosevelt. And I had done my little presentation. She came in late, a few people behind her, looking very lordly. I was quite struck at how tall she was.
She was, and, 6 feet.
And she had some sort of fur on her. She looked really quite stately and quite impressive as she came down the front, the center aisle, and mounted the podium, and instantly everything stopped, and she delivered her her speech. And when the occasion was over, she was about to dash away, but she was very courteous to the few other people on the panel. And she turned to me and said, "I'm so sorry I missed your presentation, but I hear it was excellent." And I'm sure nobody told her that, but it was a kind of courtesy that, you know, meant a good deal to a, to a.
And you didn't call her on it.
I surely did not. I said, "Thank you very much." I was quite struck with how imposing and how regal a presence she was.
Yes, she had a
this is in the 1960s, and she—I think she's only living around the corner, so to speak. She had an apartment
on Washington Square.
On Washington Square.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. No, she had an apartment there where I used to stay on my times. Vacations earlier on, but
your mother is involved in the crucial scene where your grandmother discovers that there was a last tryst between Franklin and his former inamorata, Lucy Mercer, and she was bothered by your mother's role in helping to bring them together.
Well, it wasn't a tryst, because you have to know that FDR was in contact with Lucy Mercer by letter. And particularly after Lucy Mercer's husband, Rutherford, died, and he had been to visit her on one occasion, on her, accompanied by Margaret Sukley, another friend of his, distant cousin, I believe that Lucy Mercer had a seat at the inaugural in 1936. So FDR was very lonely in those last years. In fact, he even asked my grandmother if she wouldn't spend a bit more time and not be away so much. And she did not change her schedule. Now, I'm not laying that on her. She couldn't change her schedule. That was just in her.
She was a major public figure.
Yeah, and she went. She had to charge forward. So when FDR asked my mother, "I want you to meet a dear friend of mine. I don't know, you've probably heard of Lucy Mercer and who she was in my life. Anyway, I'd like to have her for dinner. And whenever Mother's away, can you take charge of this?" It's the sort of thing Missy Lehan would have handled had she been alive.
His former secretary.
His former secretary and confidant, so forth, and very influential. But my mother was really caught, because she knew damn well eventually my grandmother would find out about this. But she went along with it because she felt Pa, she tells me the story, he desperately needed company in the evenings. And so, although he worked late after dinner, but it was at dinner time he wanted company. And so many people had dropped out of his life. Anyway, so there she was. But it wasn't a tryst. She was there for dinner. She was there for tea. They went for a ride in Rock Creek Park. It was about it.
This is shortly before.
Before he died. In the last year, year and a half of his life.
We are about to pause for an update on the news. When we return, I want to talk about something quite other than all that we've been discussing so far, namely a film that you've had a hand in, and which is about to premiere in Chicago.
Yes.
And it relates, of all things, to another fascinating figure, the Grand Duchess Charlotte of Luxembourg.
And the friendship she had with FDR.
And so we'll talk about that and talk some about that film after we go to the newsroom for a full update from Paula Cooper. And we return to Curtis Roosevelt. We've taken advantage of his visit to Chicago to talk with him about his excellent, recently published work, Too Close to the Sun, Growing Up in the Shadow of My Grandparents, Franklin and Eleanor. That is, by the way, just published, last year published by Public Affairs Books. But actually, you're here for yet another purpose in town.
I'm here, really here to help participate in the premiere of a film about the Grand Duchess of Luxembourg and her role in World War II, very critical role for Luxembourg. And particularly my part in it is to talk about the relationship she had with my grandfather, mm-hmm. Franklin Roosevelt.
And with us in the studio, and indeed now at the table and behind microphones, are three additional guests. Jean-Paul Senninger is the Luxembourg ambassador to the United States, also to Canada, isn't that right?
That's right, yes.
And as well, two young women who are essentially the producers of the film that we've just referred to, Candace Allen Olson and Lynn Rothwell. Lynn, tell us something about the film itself.
Well, it's a feature-length film. It's a beautiful story about the Grand Duchess of Luxembourg. And during the Second World War, Luxembourg was a neutral country, but the Nazis came in and took over. And she made the decision, along with her government, that if this happened, she would flee the country, and this would be a signal that the country was still an independent country. So they made their way down through occupied France and ended up in Portugal. So there was a dilemma there. What would she do? And the year before, her husband, Prince Felix, had met President Roosevelt. And he said, if anything happens, I will take the royal children. So the inevitable happened. The country was invaded. There they were in Portugal. A message was sent to Roosevelt, and he sent a warship, the Trenton, to pick up the royal children. Now, America wasn't in the war at this time, so he couldn't actually take the Grand Duchess. But what he was doing was really stepping out and nailing his colours to the mast, doing what he thought was the right thing, despite the criticism that would come from this, and, you know, take this, I suppose, refugee royal family into America.
But once the country falls to the Nazis, The Grand Duchess does indeed come. She leaves the country and she shows up at the White House, doesn't she?
She did later come, but she only came to the White House after I don't think she was in the White House prior to Pearl Harbor.
No, she continued to London and set up government there. And part of the film is about her use of the BBC to broadcast hope back to her people, basically saying, this is, well, you'll know the power of broadcasting, really. I'm okay. I'm working for you on the outside. I'm going to tell the Allies what's happening in the country, and you're going to be rescued.
She would begin each broadcast, I gather, with the greeting, Leif Letzeburger. Do I say it correctly?
That's correct. Yes.
What does it mean?
My dear... Dear Luxembourgers.
Yeah, dear Luxembourgers. Yeah. And once a week she would do that?
She would do it on a regular basis. And, of course, it was very difficult for the Luxembourgers back home to have news from the outside world, because listening to foreign radio stations was strictly forbidden. And, well, word spread around Luxembourg rather quickly that the Grand Duchess was on the air on specific dates, and still today, people remember the force of her communication skills and the hope that she inspired to her people during these crucial days.
She must have been just down the hall from Charles de Gaulle. They probably both were broadcasting from the old BBC building at Portland Place. And de Gaulle was on the air regularly. He would always open with Français, c'est de Gaulle qui parle.
Yes, but de Gaulle had a larger audience.
To be sure.
Yeah. And you still have to bear in mind that, after all, Luxembourg is half the size of Rhode Island. And, of course, it wasn't easy for the government in exile to convince the BBC that such a small nation deserved... some space on the air, but for us it was extremely important, and helped the resistance movement in Luxembourg quite a lot.
She returns after the war. Did you, as a young man, know her at all, or as a child?
Sorry, I didn't get the question.
Did you know the Grand Duchess?
Yes, of course. She abdicated in 64 and lived a couple of years later, longer.
Her son succeeded her.
Her son
and now her grandson.
And now her grandson is the actual Grand Duke. But she's one of the great figures that is part of our national identity, and she helped forging the nation during her long reign between 1919 and 62.
Let's hear a bit more about the film and also the venue where it will be visible in Chicago. Candace?
Well, the film, which is called Charlotte, a Royal at War, is actually representing Luxembourg at the Jean Siskel Film Centre, and it will have a screening tomorrow on Tuesday at 8 o'clock. And we had a previous screening at the beginning of the month, which was received very well. And part of the reason why I believe the Jean Siskel Film Centre chose our film is because it's partly filmed in Chicago. The Grand Duchess Charlotte actually came here to Chicago during the Second World War to rally support for Luxembourg and to tell Americans who, and America at the time was not in the war, about what was happening back home in occupied Europe.
There is a sort of a Luxembourger colony or settlement of long standing in Chicago and north of Chicago as well.
Yes, that's true. In fact, it's the largest Luxembourgish population outside of Luxembourg. I believe there's 125,000 Luxembourgers or Americans of Luxembourg descent here. And
that's about one-fifth of the present population of Luxembourg.
Yes, yes, that's true. And a lot of them, when they first moved over, were flower growers. And we actually interviewed one of the descendants who met the Grand Duchess when she came here on one of her so-called propaganda tours.
Now, what is the role of one Curtis Roosevelt in this film?
Well, President Roosevelt played a key factor in helping to liberate Luxembourg. The Battle of the Bulge is really what set Luxembourg free, finally. It was liberated twice, the first time being on September the 9th in 1944. Luxembourg was first liberated by the American army. And then again, the Battle of the Bulge hit everyone very hard around Christmas time of that year. And then finally, the U.S. 5th Armored Division liberated Luxembourg for the final time in 1945. And that's when the Grand Duchess actually went back to her country. And many people today believe it was her friendship with President Roosevelt that helped keep Luxembourg on the map and let him and the other allies know that Luxembourg had a right to exist and to remain independent and not become part of Belgium or any of the other countries after the war.
So you talk about that, Curtis.
I would, because it's typical of FDR, the kind of personal diplomacy. He didn't consult the State Department when he sent that light cruiser to Lisbon to pick up the royal family. And he began corresponding with the Grand Duchess Charlotte. And then, of course, she came to visit. But you could look at it, wasn't it nice that they had a friendship? And eventually the last letters are, "Dear Lottie," and her last letter that she wrote to him, which came a couple of months, just before he went to Yalta, was signed Charlotte brackets Lottie. You know, they were friendly. That's all very nice and, cozy. But what is lost is that by his taking this initiative, recognizing her, he did put Luxembourg, or kept it on the map. Mm-hmm. This is the real thing, is to keep it on the map. And by recognizing her and having this relationship of friendship with her, it was symbolically very important for Luxembourg in the post-war period, when there was a lot of planning. And Luxembourg, didn't do well after World War I and might very well have been under the same kinds of threats or not gotten its share of aid or what have you. But this friendship between the two heads of state, heads of government as well, was very important in seeing that occur.
And you recount some of that in this film,
yes,
of course.
Yes, a bit of it. Not as much as I would like to have done, but I was not as prepared as as I am now.
I trust you are now prepared to take some questions. We're going to pause in just a moment for the usual reasons, and then on to the phones. The phone lines are now open. The number, as ever, 591-7200. 312, the area code, then 591-7200 for any question you want to pose, or any memory, for that matter, among the older folks that you want to share about those times and about the reign of the Roosevelts. 312-591-7200. If you are listening at a great distance and would rather reach us via email, the email address is, as ever, also extension 720, one word, extension 720, at Tribune, TRIBUNE.com. So, 312-591-7200 or extension 720 at Tribune.com. We look forward to your messages, whether by phone or by email. Get them in quickly. We shall return. There's a phrase from World War II uttered by General MacArthur. He said, I shall return. We shall return directly after this. And we return to to Curtis Roosevelt, author of Too Close to the Sun, grandson, of course, of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. And our other guests at the table, as we have been talking just in the last few minutes about the new film about Grand Duchess Charlotte of Luxembourg, those guests are the Luxembourg ambassador to the United States and to Canada, namely Jean-Paul Senninger, or Senninger, as they would say. Is that right?
That's right.
Back home. And as well, the producers of the film that we've been talking about, Candace Allen Olson and Lynn Rothwell. 591-7200 is the number for any questions, comments, memories that you'd like to share. And we'll go directly to Edward here in Chicago. And you, sir, are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, Dr. Rosenberg. Hello?
Yes, sir. Go ahead, please.
Yes, a wonderful show, as always. It's an honor to speak to Franklin Roosevelt's grandson. What I wanted to ask him was how he thinks his grandfather, if he were president today, would be handling things like these economic stimuli, giving taxpayers $600 back on their tax returns, and whether he'd be bailing out the automobile companies and the Wall Street brokers and the banks, and just what he would do, what his grandson thinks his grandfather would have done.
Well, the circumstances are so different today compared to the Great Depression in the 29, 33, and so forth, that it's impossible to answer that. The only thing that I can say is that the one major difference in 1933, when FDR was inaugurated, the whole country was in a level of depression that everybody knew about it. Nobody would have questioned, not even the biggies on Wall Street would have in any way questioned that we were in dire straits. I don't have that impression today. They're still arguing as to whether technically we're in a recession or a depression. Well, ask the people who've lost their homes, ask the people who've lost their jobs,
right,
so forth.
And may I say, sir, I believe if your grandfather had not given us all these great programs like Social Security and unemployment and welfare, that we would indeed be back in the 1930s.
I think you're probably right.
Yes, I do.
And you know, you talk about the difference in Europe, and their difference in approach, which President Obama is tackling in London right at this time, stems, one of them is that the Europeans have a much broader, deeper social network, safety net, so to speak, across the board, both unemployment, medical, etc., that we don't have in this country. And so, in a way, they're tackling the depression that they have in a different way. But may I just go back to your question? I think, and I wrote a letter in the New York Times on the 20th of January, published, in which I say that when you compare the two situations of 1933 and today, I have no doubt that Barack Obama has a much tougher situation to handle than FDR did.
Well, I think in terms of the money involved, it probably is tougher. It just seems to me that the Europeans learned more from your grandfather than our own country did.
I don't know how to comment about that.
Yeah, because they seem to have seen the light when he pointed them in the right direction, and we seem to have reversed course.
You sound like a Democrat.
I have been one all my life, sir.
Well, okay. Yeah. But you know, I mean, there were a lot of bankers who met with the president, I don't know, a few days ago. And the only comment on the side is that we told the president, said one banker, that he's got to stop being so anti-Wall Street. Seeming to me, in syndicate, the Wall Street bankers don't understand.
Sarah, we thank you for the call, and it is time to invite more calls. We've got some lines available. If you are a veteran of those times, person once said, I forget who, that the past is another country. But there are those who have visited that country who are old enough to remember the days of the Roosevelts and to share their own memories, their own impressions from a distance, a far greater distance than obtained for Curtis Roosevelt, their own impressions of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. 591-7200 is the number. And if you want to call, get in there quickly, 312, the area code, then 591-7200. Or for email, extension 720 at tribune.com. Usually on a program like this, we get some calls from our listeners on the Pacific Rim who are enjoying a midday in Australia or in Japan or in Malaysia. And we'd be happy to hear from them again tonight. 591-7200 as we go to Roger here in Chicago. Good evening. Hello, are you there? Hello, hello, Roger, going once, going twice. And Roger isn't there.
Yes.
Yes, sir, go ahead, please.
Hello.
I'm here. If you turn down your radio, you'll have an easier time of it.
Yes. I was just curious if Mr. Roosevelt was close at all with Theodore Roosevelt's son, Teddy Jr., who was on the staff, Eisenhower's staff during World War II.
No, I wasn't. Unfortunately, the only contact I've had is to visit his grave in Normandy. You know, he died. He was very early on in the Normandy landings and was brigadier general, assistant division commander, and then was given responsibility for one of the charge of one of the ports after the Normandy landing, and then unfortunately had a heart attack. And died. I never met him.
Eleanor was a close relative of Theodore Roosevelt, much closer than was Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, Franklin Roosevelt was a fifth cousin. Well, they were fifth cousins. Theodore Roosevelt Eleanor Roosevelt was Theodore Roosevelt's niece, which makes Theodore Roosevelt to me a great uncle.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm very proud of, too.
You're more closely related to Theodore Roosevelt than Franklin Roosevelt was.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Through my grandmother. No, it's all very complicated. And
genealogical charts always are.
Yes, I know. But it has fascinated me, and I do feel Theodore Roosevelt is a much underrated president. He didn't have the kind of crisis that would have lifted him out and showed his mettle.
But he had his little war.
Oh, you mean, yes, but that's before he was president.
Yeah,
nobody remembers the Spanish-American War.
Well, that's where he made
his reputation.
Which
century was it in, you know? No, it was a little war.
Yeah. We are due for an update on the news, and for that, to the newsroom and Paula Cooper. And returning directly to Curtis Roosevelt, we've been drawing from his excellent new book, Too Close to the Sun. Growing up in the shadow of my grandparents, Franklin and Eleanor. I might have added, this book is wonderfully illustrated. There are great photographs. And are they from your personal collection?
Yes, or? Most of them are. The rest of them from the library at Hyde Park. But the cover, the jacket,
wonderful
comes from
picture.
A picture that I found in La Vanguardia, the leading newspaper of Barcelona.
You had never seen it before?
I'd never seen it before.
This is little Curtis, age four, or I would guess, sitting on his mother's lap in an open car, and his sister sitting on his on her grandfather's lap.
That's correct. Yeah. Just the four of us. But I love that old car.
Yeah.
It's a vintage automobile.
Yes, beautiful picture. Back to the phones, 591-7200, as we go to Ted up in Evanston. Good evening.
Yes. Hello.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Is this the program?
Well, it's either is the program or somebody does a very good imitation of it.
Oh, okay. I believe I went to a school for about a year with your guest, who we knew as Buzzy, up at Lake Geneva.
At the military academy, did
yeah,
you mention?
Yeah, right.
That's, fact, we I, did. I, all I know is Ed. Tell me your last name.
Ted. Brooke. Oh. You won't remember the name. I sat next to you at Mr. Demetrius's ancient history class.
I do.
I was a chubby fellow.
That's a long time ago. You must be my age, for goodness sake.
Yes. You know, that's one question I had. From what I've read in the biographies of the quality of food in the White House because of the housekeeper there, our school must have prepared you pretty well for that. You must have felt at home.
Well, it was the other way around. The White House prepared me for the school at Northwestern.
Yeah, right.
For the food at Northwestern.
Yeah.
No, it was unfortunately poor.
Yeah.
And people in Washington, from journalists to politicians, diplomats, knew when they went to the White House for a lunch or a dinner that it was not going to be great.
I'm sure that's changed by now.
Oh, Jacqueline Kennedy is the one who changed that.
Regular listeners to this program know that I got a small honor at the White House a few months ago, in the last month or two of the Bush administration, actually. And after the occasion, there were hors d'oeuvres served in the public rooms, and they were the best hors d'oeuvres I've ever eaten any place. I had my grandchildren and family with me, and both of my grandchildren were absolutely captivated by the food and gobbled it away for the full hour and a half that we were there.
You know, one thing that always fascinates me now is with all the security that people have these days, particularly, you know, connected with the president, I never remember seeing anybody lurking in the in the background for you. Was there?
No. I had no Secret Service men with me at Northwestern.
Yeah.
But one always met me when I got on the train to come to Chicago so forth.
Yeah.
But you had them with you when you were a little boy out in Seattle.
I was never without them from age 3 to age 15.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in a way, I knew Secret Service men far better than anybody my own age.
Mm-hmm.
They were my companions.
Our thanks to the caller, and we'll go directly to another, 591-7200, as we turn to Howard up in Geneva. Good evening. Yes, sir, are you there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Please turn off your radio.
Well, I'll go out in a different room.
One thing or the other. This is a rare event tonight. We're getting callers who seem not to know that they're supposed to turn their radios off. Are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Please continue.
Okay, I'll stay here.
I fear we can't go any further with that one, sir, so we'll go to this caller. This one being John in DeKalb. Good evening.
Hi. We've all seen pictures of the house up at Hyde Park, and we've always heard that Roosevelt was accused of being a traitor to his class. Out of curiosity, how did the Roosevelts and the Delnos originally make their money?
Well, the Roosevelts made their money in trade in the the Caribbean, and then they got a leg up socially as they went along, and when the English aristocracy left the revolution, the Dutch moved in, and maybe there was a Luxembourgian among them, I don't know, but the Dutch moved in. And the Delanos made their money in shipping in the China trade, which did include the opium trade. Their ships would, while they were waiting to put together their deals with the Chinese, which was a very long, drawn-out process, the ships went to Calcutta to pick up the opium, which then went back to China, feeding the unfortunate habit that had developed there.
Is there a Luxembourgish connection? I was told that the Delanos have such a connection.
Well, for many years, FDR thought there was a connection, and there's even a chateau with a Delanois-related name.
Uh-huh.
And you see in those letters to the Grand Duchess Charlotte that he was glad to hear that his chateau, or the family chateau, had been spared. Well, the fact is, it's been since unearthed, that the Delano family were a very poor family, came from a small village near Lille, and went to Hamburg. In Hamburg, in the wool trade, they made a little money. And then they came to the United States, both Roosevelts and Delanos being in that sort of pilgrim group, either in the first or the second boat in the Mayflower routine.
You are now considered, and you accept this designation, I gather, the family historian.
Well, I have enough first cousins not to formally accept it. But let's say I have...
You've undertaken to do the work.
Yeah, okay. I was trying to find a polite way of saying it. I've read the books, and I've read the books now for 20 years, so that I am in a position to comment with some perspective. And it's been good. It's been a real identity for me, which has emerged in the last 10 to 15 years.
Well, now, what other Rooseveltian projects do you have, apart from this fine book, Too Close to the Sun?
A second book, which I'm hard at work at, a series of essays which it explores a little bit with other people, what happened to other people, my uncles, my stepfather, my mother, because this matter of being too close to the sun is a serious business. For a little boy, you can see, oh, I hope my book conveys, yes, it was a game and fun, but the distortion that it left me with was a lifelong struggle to emerge from. I'm also writing about Eleanor Roosevelt's search for love, the personal relationship between Winston Churchill and FDR, what it meant to be a cripple, even though you are President of the United States, and because you're a paraplegic, you're dependent on people every moment of the day. You can't get out of bed without somebody to assist you. And nobody has ever written about the simple, practical effect. So I have a series of essays, 10 or 12 of them, and they will be in a second book. That's my project at the moment, although I have other projects, raising money for the library at Hyde Park and so forth.
Oh. Well, you're a very ambitious writer. Obviously. And because you had a long career as a... Of course, you were in the UN for many years.
That's where I draw my pension, 18 years.
I see.
Yes.
But beyond that,
that's an important element.
Beyond that, you did a good deal of journalistic writing, didn't you?
Yes. Since that time, I wrote for El Mundo and Le Figaro. And I guess those are the two major ones. But I haven't been that successful as a journalist. One tends to be dismissed as an apologist for the Roosevelts because of being a Roosevelt. But and also, it's taken me a long time to learn to write. Now, you admired my writing, and I can't tell you how you set me up for the evening.
Oh, it's a wonderful narrative as you give it. It's personally written, but at the same time, there's much historical insight, and it has a grace in the flow of the language. Absolutely.
Well, I wrote the captions to the and my editor at my publisher was not at all happy with my flip.
That reminds me of one mystery, and it relates to an illustration. And you keep it a mystery, I guess. Maybe you just don't know the answer to the mystery. And that is the picture of Eleanor Roosevelt as Whistler's mother.
Ah, because it is a mystery. Nobody knows the answer.
It's posed exactly to duplicate the famous Whistler portrait of his mother.
Oh, yes, it was. She obviously went, posed for this picture, had it framed.
Who took the picture, by the way?
I don't know. But she sent it around to my mother, all my uncles, my grandfather, and I'm not sure who else, but they all received this picture. And, of course, we talked on the phone at Christmas, etc., with the question, you know, Mommy, what's the picture all about? And she just laughed and said nothing further. So to this day, nobody knows what got into Eleanor Roosevelt to have that picture taken.
It was a devilish moment.
I guess so.
We have a merely commercial moment, or at least a commercial 3 minutes before us, and then directly back to the phones on 591-7200. And we return for our last round of telephone calls between now and 11 o'clock. And we go directly and quickly back to the phones and to Vernon in Harwood Heights, I believe. You're on the air. Good evening.
Hello. I'd like Curtis Roosevelt to tell what he knows about President Roosevelt's contact with the British secret agents with the code name Intrepid.
I know nothing about that.
Oh.
I refer you to Joe Persico's book on FDR's setting up that
relationship. What was the title?
I don't remember, but the author's name is Persico.
Joseph,
Persico?
P-E-R-S-I-C-O. Oh, thank you.
But in just one quick word on that, the Americans had no formal intelligence service other than Navy intelligence and the Army Signal Corps, so that we didn't have anything comparable to MI5 or MI6. And it wasn't until later that they began to work with the British. Whether the OSS ever worked with Intrepid would be in Persico's book.
There is, in fact, a book titled A Man Called Intrepid, I believe, which
right,
gives you
right.
the full story of this fellow.
Yeah.
Who was a major British agent in this country in the years before our entry into the war. And after as well.
Yeah.
591-7200. Recently, we had here an author who had done a biography of Roald Dahl, the writer of those famous children's books and so on. And Dahl, apparently, was one of the major British agents in Washington trying to influence, among others, the President of the United States and trying to turn America towards participation in World War II.
I have always questioned those objectives because FDR was totally... and far, desirous of getting the U.S. Not necessarily into war, but geared up for war, and it's the one failure he had in foreign policy is that he never could arouse the American people until Pearl Harbor. Arouses.
Well, the Japanese helped, and Hitler helped a few days later by declaring war on Earth.
That's right.
We go to Sam in Chicago. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening. Did your grandparents ever make derogatory remarks about racial and religious minorities in this country?
To the contrary, they were both champions, particularly my grandmother. I can remember as a teenager greeting and being kissed hello by Mrs. Bethune, and I don't remember her first name.
Mary... Beth
I think Mary. And also, I knew Marian Anderson and you know, chatted with her. No, it was to the contrary. Both of them were very supportive of minorities. And Henry Morgenthau, Secretary of the Treasury, was my Uncle Henry as a child because we were neighbors along the Hudson River.
We thank you, sir, for the call, and we go quickly to another 591-7200 and to Bob in Mount Prospect. Good evening.
Yes, hello. Wonderful show. First thing I want to say is my father just absolutely worshipped your grandfather. He thought he was the absolute greatest.
Well, that's always nice to hear. But tell me a little more about you.
Well, My question is actually, and I hope I have the right lineage, do you have any recollections of Alice Roosevelt, that very colorful lady? And then I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you.
We thank you, sir.
Yes, I do. She was not only a character, she had a very sharp tongue, but not just a sharp tongue, she had an acid tongue, and she enjoyed making people uncomfortable. But I will tell you, there was one time that Cousin Alice...
She's the daughter of Theodore Roosevelt.
The eldest child, and she married the Speaker of the House, Longworth, and she was Alice Roosevelt Longworth. But anyway, when I knew her, Longworth was not on the scene. But one time, my grandmother made Cousin Alice uncomfortable. My grandmother always had cousins over at least once a year. It's just a matter of form. And at the end of lunch, my grandmother turned to Cousin Alice and said, Alice, dear, I understand you do a marvelous of impersonation of me, and I wondered over coffee if you'd do it for us. Well, Alice Roosevelt was petrified and disappeared. She, for once, somebody got the upper hand.
She's famous for the line. I suppose she must have actually uttered it rather often. If you have nothing to say, if you have nothing nice to say about anybody, come sit next to me.
Yes. She took great delight in, and she was clever in having that sharp remark about people.
But of course, she's the Alice of whom the in the song, the Alice Blue Gown.
Yes,
it refers, I think, to her wedding. I'm not sure.
Well, I don't know her wedding.
It's a famous wedding.
Yes, in the White House. Yeah. In the White House, it was.
We go back to the phones, 591-7200, and Margaret in Lake Forest, you are on the air. Good evening.
Hi. It's a pleasure and an honor to speak to both of you. I do have a question. I'd like to know if FDR, so disliked Joe Kennedy that he sent him over to London, and also... if he didn't trust Kennedy with, you know, the markets, and thus had him write and help write the SEC guidelines.
I'm sorry, I didn't get the last phrase.
The SEC guidelines.
Oh, did he follow the SEC guidelines?
No, I understand it, that Joe Kennedy was instrumental in writing and revising the guidelines.
Well, he was the first chairman of the SEC.
That's right.
Right, that's right. So, and because FDR didn't, FDR knew he knew how to manipulate it, thus he had Joe Kennedy chair it and write many of the policies.
I think so, but you know, it doesn't really matter today because the financial world is just so much more complicated than what was written by Joe Kennedy or anybody else in 1933 is not all that relevant today. But he then went to be, he was assigned as the ambassador to the Court of St. James in London. And John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy spent some years in London. But Joe Kennedy was one of those people who felt that the British were going to go under. And it wasn't an unrealistic assessment, he's been accused of being pro-Nazi. I don't think that is fair. I think he was simply, he thought the Germans were going to win and would be occupying Britain, and that the United States should be more friendly to Germany. That's who we were going to have to live with. That was his, after rather cryptic paraphrase.
Our thanks to the caller, and here is Howard in Geneva. Good evening.
Yes, good evening, Mr. Rosenberg. I'm calling for the two producers, Candace Olson and Lynn Roswell. I'd be interested in knowing how they came about with the idea of producing this movie.
Well, let us ask them. Happily, they're still right here at the table.
Well, this is Candy speaking. My grandmother's actually a Luxembourger, and I grew up in Luxembourg. And for anyone who grew up in Luxembourg or has any link to the country, the Second World War is still very real today. And my grandmother is 98, and she speaks about the Second World War as if it happened yesterday. So really, it was her stories of the Grand Duchess Charlotte and how she looked up to her that inspired me to start looking into the BBC archives and undertaking some research and realizing there was a film there.
I see.
And I think your grandmother also told you about listening to the BBC, and I mean, it was really dangerous. I mean, some people were sent to concentration camps if you were caught. So,
while we're focused on this, let's just quickly review the actual occasion tomorrow. The film is to be shown at the
Gene Siskel
Film Center. At what time?
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock.
And what's the exact address? It's on State Street, is it not?
It's North State Street. It's opposite the Chicago Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I thank you very much.
We thank you, sir, for the call.
You're welcome.
We are virtually out of time. My apologies to those still waiting on the phone lines, but there wouldn't be time enough for a full telephone call. Writing an autobiographical volume of any sort brings you out, I think. I'm often told by people who have done that. I never have. But brings you out at some new destination that you didn't expect to arrive at. You learn something that you didn't intend to learn or know about before you started. Is that true for you and this volume?
Yes, I like to say that it did me 10 years of doing research. But actually, a large part of the research was looking inside me and ascertaining the truth. That took 10 years, maybe 15.
Should I make so bold as to ask you what you learned about yourself that you didn't know before?
Well, gosh, so much. Except that I began to see how distorted my life had been,
mm-hmm.
and the effect of being too close to the sun. But at the same time, I'd moved out of it. And it was a great relief, really. And then I needed the project, and I began to write.
And it has eventuated in a wonderful volume, an excellent memoir. And you don't have to be somebody who lived through the Roosevelt era to enjoy it. You'll learn a great deal about the Roosevelt era and the central figure and various other figures around him. And you'll have a fine time just in terms of appreciating good literary work if you get Too Close to the Sun by Curtis Roosevelt. With that, we are indeed out of time. Tomorrow night, a program about the ways in which people misuse books, crimes against books. What that means, you will discover tomorrow. Until then, thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.